Jones Topsoil has been delivering topsoil, mulch, sand, and gravel. For greener lawns and brighter flower beds, call 1-800-TOPSOIL. Order online at jonestopsoil.com.
Jones Topsoil brings it home to you.
For over 100 years, Jones Topsoil has been part of your community, delivering topsoil, mulch, sand, and gravel. Slinger Jones bringing it home to you. Whether you're planting a vibrant flower bed, growing your own vegetables, or giving your lawn a fresh start, be the envy of the neighborhood with topsoil and mulch from Slinger Jones. For greener lawns and brighter flower beds, call 1-800-TOPSOIL. Order online at jonestopsoil.com.
Jones Topsoil brings it home to you.
Coming up on this week's show, a new Ron Gilbert Monkey Island game is coming.
Play classic PlayStation games on your PlayStation 5.
And we chat to the angry video game nerd, James Rolfe.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our amazing mates at Bitmap Books. Now, something you need to check out from them that comes out again next month, reprints are due in May, Metal Slug, The Ultimate History. If you're a fan of that series, it is a must read. Packed full of conceptual artwork, behind the scenes info and exclusive interviews. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 321. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for another nostalgia-filled episode, taking you behind the scenes on the world of classic video games. Of course, bringing you up to speed on all the big stories in retro gaming and tech over the last 7 days. And bringing you an exclusive guest on the show as well. Now, I think we might need to just calm Joe down a little bit before we get our guest on this week.
Hold me back. We finally pinned him down. We finally got him. The man, the legend, James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd. The thing is with James Rolfe is he already talks a lot about like behind the scenes and how he got into it and stuff. So we just kind of spoke mainly about his memories, didn't we? And it was like, It was really chill. And it was like just talking to a mate because of, I don't know about you guys, but I've been watching AVGN literally for 15 years.
Like, yeah, I couldn't do it because he burnt a CD32. So, but yeah, no, I've been from the beginning of YouTube. I was watching AVGN, yeah. And he was the first real kind of blow up channel, wasn't he? And really exposed me to the odd titles that were out there.
It's a weird one. So I was like 17. It was like 2006, 2007. And I started watching him. And it was because of him I got into going to Car Boots and rebuying like Mega Drive games and Master System games and stuff. So for me, it was just like such a nostalgia trip and it was so awesome. And literally, Dan, you've been talking to him for about 5 years, haven't you?
Like, yeah, and off and on emailing every 6 months or so.
And he always responds. He always does respond and you always have a back.
He's a busy guy though.
He always has a back and forth with you, but he's always very apologetic. But this time he was just like, yeah, you know what, let's do it. And, you know, we got a decent, he said he didn't have long, but we got a decent amount of time out of him.
Your persistence paid off, Dan. There you go.
Yeah, man. So it was really, really fun. So, yeah, I can't wait to listen back to it.
Well, it is, you're right. Cause, I mean, you know, you kind of think about that, you know, that original generation of retro gaming YouTubers, and not many of them have, you know, lasted the course like James has.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them kind of, you know, you got to like 5 years after they started by like 2010, 2011. A lot of them kind of given up, haven't they? Or the channels are changing to something else.
Yeah.
But James, I mean, he's been there. It must be coming up on, God, it must be nearly 20 years since he did that first episode in around 2004, I think, wasn't it?
2004, I believe. You know, I mean, we talk about it on the interview and stuff, but yeah, 2004, he kind of first did the Angry Video Game, the Angry Nintendo Game Nerd episodes, which kind of started off at him at university, kind of passing him around to his friends on VHS before they then got uploaded onto YouTube.
Hasn't he got like a movie and a video game as well? I think I've actually got the AVGN video game on my Wii U,
He's got about 3 games, I think. And then he's got the movie, like you say, which he directed and everything. And like, you know, that was kind of like, funny enough, that was like my first ever the first time I saw something crowdfunded as well, because he got that. I don't think he did it on Kickstarter or anything. He just did his own kind of crowdfunding for it.
Am I right in thinking he did like location videos of where movies were shot as well? So really early on, I remember like Back to the Future and stuff like that.
Yeah, he used to do videos for Spike.com, kind of like in the late 2000s, you know, like 2008, 2009. and he used to do a lot of movie reviews, but then he'd also do a lot of, like you say, he'd go to all the Rocky locations and, you know, the Back to the Future locations and stuff like that. So, you know, he doesn't just do video games. He does a lot like Monster Madness and always talks about films and stuff. So he was always one of my go-to YouTubers. You know, I think they used to come out on Wednesdays, and I used to always be excited to watch the new AVGN. So, like I say, a real, real nostalgia trip for me.
And I think he did a lot as well to kind of educate people that maybe didn't have first-hand experience of not only the games, but the systems as well.
Oh, yeah.
See, I mean, you know, growing up in, like, you know, the 80s and 90s, we had a different view of gaming to what they had in America, you know, like home computers.
Yeah, he's very nice, isn't he? And those kind of consoles.
Even Atari stuff. Like, you know, I'd never played an Atari 5200 before I saw his video. And, you know, that came out in like 2008. And, you know, I wasn't familiar at all with that system. So I think he's done a lot to kind of, and also raise the prices on eBay as well.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But yeah, no, you're 100% right. His videos have completely educated me. Like, I would have a guess that I didn't know a Mega Drive was called a Genesis in America until I saw AVGN.
It's kind of like opening up the American market to the Europeans, which he probably didn't think he was doing at the time, but it did definitely kind of help. And I can imagine he thought I was just doing it for kind of the American audience, but everybody was watching that, you know.
An absolute veteran of the YouTube scene, and also, you know, retro gaming kind of content creation in general, I think. So James Rolfe, I mean, the amount of content creators we get on who's, you know, if you always ask any YouTuber we get on, who is your inspiration? James always gets a name check, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
So really excited to talk to him. James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, is going to be our special guest on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, we've got lots of news stories to get through. First of all, though, some breaking news at the time of recording this week's episode. And I have to kind of not fangirl too much over this, because when Ravi sent me this link, I was actually shopping in Morrison's at the time.
You were like,
looking
what?
On my phone. I was trying to watch this trailer on my phone in the middle of Morrison's while, you know, the missus is like, pay attention, we're shopping. But this is Ron Gilbert is finally making a new Monkey Island game. Now, for Monkey Island fans, this is massive news. I mean, the last game that, you know, Ron did in the Monkey Island series was Monkey Island 2 back in 1992. So finally getting a new Ron game following on that story is just something we've wanted for like 30 years.
Because I remember we've talked about this before, and there was always that kind of assumption that it would never happen. And that I think the rights were with Disney or someone like that. So it was kind of like, oh, there's this amazing series, but it's been taken out of the hands of the original creator, and he kind of can't get the rights back. But this announcement's come out, and apparently he said on Twitter that he's been working on it for 2 years already in secret.
Yeah, which leads me to believe, I mean, there is a trailer that landed and it is very cryptic. We'll talk a bit about the graphics and stuff in it soon, but the only thing that you kind of see in there is like a skeleton pirate playing a violin, and then there's Murray the Skull, who I think was actually in Monkey Island 3 that Ron had nothing to do with, which is quite a curious inclusion. But I'll play you the little clip of the trailer, and this is pretty much all we hear in the trailer.
Ron Gilbert told me he'd never make another Monkey Island unless...
And that is it.
It's interesting because I thought, like, just seeing Monkey Island and his name associated together, I thought it would be like a rip-off, like Gorilla Island or something, you know, when people don't get the rights and they've got to kind of do something different. But yeah, he must have done a deal then and kind of got it. So how many in the series are there, Dan? Because you're like a resident Monkey Island expert.
Oh, God, there are a lot of them. I mean, obviously, you had the first two games that Ron made, and Monkey Island 2 was actually left on a bit of a cliffhanger. If you've never played Monkey Island 2, spoilers here, skip forward 30 seconds. But we found out that, so you've got Guybrush Threepwood, who's the main character in Monkey Island who you play, and his arch nemesis, LeChuck, the ghost pirate. And he actually found out at the end of Monkey Island 2 that they were related. But that story arc was never spoken about again, really, in the series, as far as I can remember. So kind of, you know, we didn't really find out the conclusion of that. So I'm hoping, with now Ron getting his hands on this game, I mean, there's not much information out about it. At the time of recording, this trailer literally landed, what, 3 hours ago, didn't it? So it's very new. But from what I've read, the comments and stuff so far on the threads on Twitter, he's kind of going to pretend that the games after Monkey Island 2 didn't exist. Okay. So this is going to kind of be a follow-on to Monkey Island 2. But after that, we had, like, you know, Curse of Monkey Island, Escape of Monkey Island. There was, like, games on the PlayStation. We had the... there was a whole, like, collection of games that came out around 10 years ago that I must admit I didn't really play much of. So there's been quite a few, but obviously none of them have been made by Ron Gilbert. Well, and then we got those, you know, the special editions, the remastered versions.
Yeah, I remember them. And were they any good?
Yeah, they were really good, actually. And I think, you know, if anyone wants to kind of explore the original Monkey Island games today, that would be the way that I'd probably suggest that they try them, because it makes them a lot more accessible. And obviously you've got, you know, more modern graphics in there and you get full voice acting. And probably for modern players, it's a better way for them to experience the story than the old pixel graphic version.
Well, talking of like the voice acting here, Dominic Amato is going to return as the voice of Guybrush. And they've also got Dave Grossman on board as well as like the co-creator. So, you know, it's the original kind of crew there.
It is. And I think, you know, obviously this is something the fans have wanted for a long time. I'm not sure quite how this is happening. So I remember there was that petition, wasn't there, to get the rights of Monkey Island back into Ron's hands. Do you remember that we talked about probably about 4 years ago now on the show? And the fact that he's been working on this for 2 years either meant that petition was successful or he found a way to do it. Interestingly, though, in the trailer, if you watch it, it's got the, you know, now Lucasfilm Games are called LucasArts, but it's got the old Lucasfilm logo in there.
Yeah, maybe
well.
There was some deal going on with getting George Lucas involved to talk to Disney and somehow get the rights back. Because, yeah, Lucasfilm Games as well, really interesting.
Now, let's talk about the graphics in it, because that is something that already over the last few hours I've seen a bit of a division. Some people think it looks really nice. Other people are like, well, they should have done it pixel style like the original two games.
Oh, you've got to move on, haven't you? I think the series has moved on quite a lot, and this looks nicely done, and like it's a tiny little trailer. You never know. This could zoom out to a whole world. This could be like, you know, different perspectives on it and stuff. Yeah, I quite like it.
Yeah, graphically, it kind of looks like the Monkey Island remasters. But obviously, Ron did, you know, Thimbleweed Park, didn't he? That was kind of that original style.
Yeah, yeah. But that was more kind of a tribute and a look back to the past. Yeah. This seems like return. You're going back to the same place and situation, but probably not a kind of as retro, maybe continuing the story on. And hopefully this might be the start of a whole load of series. You know, if this goes down well, then it might continue. Mm. And, you know, Monkey Island could be a staple for like new generations and new kids to explore.
You know, I agree as well about the graphics. I think, you know, the original Monkey Island games, they always pushed the boundary of what the technology could do. And they always move forward with graphical trends. So it wouldn't be fitting to the series if it was retro-themed, I wouldn't think, you know, because that game always was something that looked good for the hardware it was running on.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it's kind of nice modern graphics. Though, interestingly, you know, because Pirates of the Caribbean, I've always thought is a total Monkey Island ripoff.
Yeah, yeah.
I always wondered if that's kind of why Disney never kind of put it out there much, you know, over the last few years. But it is quite interesting that now we're going to get like a big high-profile new Monkey Island game that apparently is, like you said, he's been working on it for 2 years. He kept it very secret, though, because actually he announced it on his blog on April Fool's Day. And a lot of people thought it was a wind-up, even though Ron famously hates April Fool's pranks.
And kind of the humour in Monkey Island has always been really good. And like if they get the tone and the humour right, I can imagine them totally ripping into Pirates of the Caribbean. And you know, it will be a parody of it. And, you know, I can't wait. Like, there's Monkey Island jokes that people quote at me at events and stuff. You know, it's
how appropriate. It's like, you fight like a cat.
Yeah, exactly. It's like legendary, you know.
Yes, I mean, I've got memories of being a kid, you know, on my Amiga 500, my brother and I, you know, hooking it up to the big TV in the living room and just being absolutely captivated by those games. You know, hours could fly by playing them. And actually, you know, this is obviously pre the days of voice acting, so I still have to do all the voices for my little brother of all the pirates and everything when we're playing it, which I will not imitate right now.
I was going to say, actually, come on, do some.
Yeah, but it's going to be going to be incredible. Have you ever played the Monkey Island games before, Joe? I don't think you're not quite a big point-and-click adventure game guy.
I was going to say, I was kind of staying quiet there because I've never played them.
I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, you've put me on the spot. I've never played them, but maybe I should check out the remasters. Maybe I should give my opinion on them, or even we could do it as an after hours, you know, where we pick games for each other before. So, you know, I should really check them out because a lot of them, like you say, they're on like Xbox One and stuff. And I think they might even be on Game Pass. I know Day of the Tentacle is, and I know that's a similar game. So,
yeah, they definitely were. They might have come off now. But yeah, they definitely were on Game Pass a while ago. I mean, I think they're only about £4 or £5 or something if you buy them. But yeah, I just think, you know, the games that I've played since then, I mean, I played, I think it's Escape from Wakanda on the PlayStation 2. I actually played that through probably about 2 years ago, actually, for the first time in a long time. Really enjoyed that. And, you know, I enjoyed Curse of Monkey Island as well. I played some of the, I'm trying to remember, I think it was the Tales of Monkey Island. That was like the series that came out in the late 2000s. Mm. I did play a few of those. I kind of gave up on it, though, for some reason, which, you know, might be something I need to revisit. But having Ron back at the helm, he's like, you know, he's the heart and soul of the Monkey Island series. So I think this is going to be something really special. So really excited.
And new kind of systems, new audiences. You know, it's 2022 and it's like you might bring a whole new generation to Monkey Island, and I think that's great. It's not just going to like die in the water.
And I think Thimbleweed Park proved that he's still got that kind of same cutting humor as well. You know,
oh, for sure.
Funny game, yeah. So there's going to be more of that in there, I'm sure. So no release date as yet. It just says 2022, but hopefully it won't be too long to wait. And if you want to check out the trailer, I'll put that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, it is interesting to see that Sony are kind of looking to return to the retro libraries for their modern systems, because it's something that really, I've got to say, on the PlayStation, it's always felt like a bit of an afterthought and something that Sony have never really felt all that bothered about compared to Xbox, you know, whereas Microsoft put a lot of time and effort into making original Xbox and Xbox 360 games playable on modern hardware. It's always felt a bit like something that Sony are not really that bothered about. But there was that big announcement last week that they're bringing the it's that PlayStation Plus Premium, I believe it's called, which is going to be their kind of alternative to Game Pass, isn't it? Where they're going to be putting some PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2 games on there at a cost.
Yeah, so you can't kind of summarize it there and hit it on the head. So
let's move on next story.
That's done. But yeah, in seriousness, I do agree with you. It's always been a bit of an afterthought. And there's always these rumors like the PlayStation 4 is going to be backwards compatible. Oh, the PlayStation 5 is going to be backwards compatible, because of obviously certain models of the PS3 were backwards compatible. Like some of them did PS1 and PS2, and some of them just did PS2, didn't they? And obviously, famously, the PlayStation 2 was completely backwards compatible with the PS1. But it's always, like you say, it's always been on the back burner, it feels like, in the last kind of like decade for PlayStation. So yeah, on the 30th of March, they announced the new PlayStation Plus subscription tiers, which we've spoke about. I think we spoke about it about this time last year, around a year ago, saying, you know, PlayStation were on about bringing out, you know, similar to Game Pass. But as you say, they've kind of locked them behind the most expensive tier. So you're going to get PS4, PS3, PS2 and PS1 games on this tier, but it's going to be $17.99 a month in dollars. So $17.99 a month. Or $50 for 3 months, or $120 for a year. So obviously it'll be a little bit cheaper for us British in pounds, I imagine.
Not normally much.
Well, yeah, it'll work out the same. It'll just be, it'll be like £15 a month or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no news at the point of us recording this on what games we're going to get or anything like that. And I mean, I have a PlayStation 4, but I literally just play The Last of Us and Bloodborne on it. Like, they're the only games I've played for it. I don't play it online or anything like that, so I'm not too sure how PlayStation Plus works at the moment, but I believe it's just like Xbox Live Gold, where you just you just get like three or four free games a month, and then you can play online, can't you?
Yeah.
So the new premium is going to be like the Game Pass, where you get all the free games, but there's several versions of that premium, isn't there? And it's the top tier one, where you get the essentially the backwards compatible retro games on it, isn't it?
It's a bit like the Switch do, you know, if you pay the higher tier, you can get the N64 and Mega Drive games
So the Switch has the NES and the SNES games, which you get for paying $3.99 a month, don't you? But then if you pay the $20 a month, you then get the N64 and the Mega Drive. So interesting that PlayStation have done the same thing, because Xbox is just straight up, you get everything.
Yeah, and it's quite expensive. So I've used Stadia, I've signed up for that. I've used GeForce Now. I've used quite a few of the services on the PC.
Yeah, you've been testing quite a few of them out for the last few months.
Yeah, streaming ones. And this seems expensive. I wonder if they're going to do a PC release of this as well. So, you know, it can be used on other systems. But I'm looking here as well. You are getting quite a few consoles there. You're getting PS3, PS2, PS1 and PSP as well.
You know what? I didn't mention that. Yeah.
So PSP, you know, that might be interesting. But it all depends how they're ported. I'm sure they'll do a good job of it, but
it just depends how many as well, though. I mean, the thing is with Xbox, you can literally put your old original Xbox or DVD, wasn't it, into your Xbox Series X, and then it will download the emulated rapid version of it straight onto your SSD.
Yeah.
So you can play it, you know, with your original disc. I imagine on this, though, Sony have never done anything like that before, really, have they? Even if you buy kind of PS2 games and stuff off the store, they're always kind of got to buy them again. You can never put your original discs in there and play
them. Third-party developers they've done a deal with to become part of this. You know, obviously they're going to have the Metal Gear Solid and all of that kind of stuff, but it's going to be which companies have they got on board.
Well, you say that they're Konami games, so...
Oh, yeah. I'm just thinking that because they were the exclusive.
But no, I see what you're saying as well. You know, you might pay this premium, but then you only actually get two PlayStation games. Like, you sat there hoping, oh, I hope I get the original Resident Evil 2 and Resident Evil 3 or, you know, Metal Gear Solid. But, you know, we just don't know at this point what we're going to get. But I'm sure, like on Game Pass or Xbox, you don't have to sign up to see what's on there. You can have a look through the library and then you can decide whether you want to pay for it or not.
If it hasn't got Pandemonium, then I'm not going to, you know, go on it.
I'm paying 50 quid a month for Pandemonium.
That's my style.
You know, it is interesting. There's, you know, some quotes in this article on The Verge of Jim Ryan, you know, the PlayStation boss. He was talking about an interview that he did back in 2017. Mm. He said they dabbled then with backwards compatibility. And he said, you know, it's one of those features that a lot of people wanted, but don't actually use it that much, which, you know, we've seen that with Xbox. I think it was something like, you know, less than 10% of people ever actually played any of the older games on the modern Xboxes. But it does seem to be a feature that a lot of people kind of say they want. And then he said he was at an event where he saw some old PS1, PS2 Gran Turismo games. And he said they looked ancient, and he was like, why would anyone ever want to play these now? So that was one of the reasons he kind of put out there for not actually doing backwards compatibility before.
Yeah, I must say, like, you know, the PS5 is an expensive console, and then getting this on top of that being more expensive than Games Pass, you would have thought that they would have tried to undercut it, you know, and maybe have the hardware expensive. But I mean,
with you just saying that then, I'm hoping... Just from what you've just said there, it's just made me think, well, maybe it's going to be a huge library.
Yeah, you know? Like everything.
Yeah, I mean, that would be amazing. I seriously doubt it. But, you know, if they suddenly turn around and go, here's 500 games across the PS1 to 3 and the PSP, you know, that would be unreal. And it would justify, you know, £15 a month or $17.99 a month.
Here's Bubsy 3D. That's what you got.
They are saying that apparently up to 340 games are going to be available on the premium tier. It doesn't say how many of those are retro games. It doesn't say.
That's a pretty decent amount. I haven't seen that. I don't know how many's on Xbox Game Pass, but it's a fair chunk. You know, you have to, when you go through the list, there's a lot of games on there. I would say it's probably more than 100.
And is it that, like, sign up once, download, and then not sign up again and still have the ability to play them?
No,
with Stadia, it was like you could play it but at 1080p instead of 4K.
No, they get deleted off your disc if you cancel. I mean, again, they're not games that you're going to own forever. And I imagine, I think you get that often on Game Pass, don't you? You can play it while it's on there. Then it says this expires in a couple of months.
Yeah, on Game Pass, it says, do you want to buy this game as well? Like next to it, like when you download it for free. It says like free with Game Pass, or would you like to buy it for £20 kind of thing? And it's the same with the Xbox Live Gold. Which is like
pretty brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, if you download a game on Xbox Live Gold, and I'm assuming it's the same on the normal PlayStation Plus, if you then your subscription to Gold runs out, you then can't play those games even if you've got them downloaded on your Xbox. So I imagine they would do the same with the PlayStation to stop people like Ravi just downloading them all and then cancelling it the next day.
Someone's going to crack it.
It's something we've talked about for years. It kind of, you know, modern day consoles are kind of turning into more of a subscription service, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, more like a Netflix kind of thing, which is inevitable, really. But I think if they are going to do that, this does kind of feel to me, though, that like Sony have kind of been forced into doing something they probably didn't really want to do because, you know, Xbox and Switch are doing... You know, this focus on retro games as well. And it always felt like Sony just wanted to be like, right, this is the new thing. But now, you know, that through market forces, they've kind of been forced into doing the retro game.
Well, at least you'll have something to play on your PS5 now, Dan.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, Ravi said that. This is announced, yeah. So, but that's the thing. I mean, for all of us who really care about our retro games, I think we just have the original systems lying around anyway. So it's not something I'm bothered about. But I can imagine, you know, for maybe someone who's a bit nostalgic and got rid of the PlayStation 1, you know, 20-odd years ago, it might be a bit of a cool thing. So another story that we'll keep an eye on. Now, what about this? This is quite a cool little game I was playing for a few minutes. Sorry, lads, that's why I was a bit late to the recording this week, because I was playing Pixel Pat on Intel's website.
I spotted this the other day. This was on April 1st, and it wasn't an April Fool's Day joke either. But yeah, Intel Pixel Pat is a celebration of the first year of the new CEO, Pat. Is it Gelsinger?
Yeah, I think so.
And it was it's essentially a celebration of him being Intel's CEO for a year, which I thought was quite an interesting move. I mean, I've never heard of the guy, but I'm not a big computer guy like you guys are. But the premise of the game is an 8-bit side-scroller, isn't it? Like, where it constantly scrolls, similar to modern mobile games, and you click to jump, and you're running through a chip factory, which I think is quite funny. And you know, you can collect light bulbs, which give you little facts about Pat, you know, like, you know, how he started his career in 1981 and the different things that he's done for Intel over the years, and how, like, you know, the reason for this factory that they've built is to kind of challenge the chip shortage that we've had over the last couple of years and stuff like that, which, you know, I think it's really interesting. But the article on TechSpot, which I think is really funny, points out right at the bottom, is maybe it's to cover up the fact that it was recently announced that he got paid $178 million last year.
Jesus.
Not that not the company made that. That's how much he made.
I'd quit after a year.
Yeah, I'd quit after a week.
Yeah. They're lying on a beach if he's got any sense.
Yeah,
next month,
so, you know, which apparently was a 698% increase on Bob Swan's pay the previous year, who was the CEO of Intel prior to that, and also 217 times more the average salary of an Intel employee.
Well, I think it's interesting that people are kind of using these like little retro games to kind of, you know, promote something or make someone seem more human or something like this,
yeah.
Like make them more fun. Like I remember that J-Lo game that we covered ages ago, which is Jenny going through the block collecting shoes.
Like, you know, what's the next one going to be? Mark Zuckerberg as a playable character in San Andreas on the Oculus Rift. To make him seem more human.
Yeah, you know, this makes me think, like, there's some young whippersnapper in the PR department. I know, let's make a video game of him. Yeah, people would love that. And they're probably all in these departments at the moment. J-Lo's and then the person got promoted to Intel.
Yeah. And you're not wrong. And I think, you know, that is potentially what it comes down to. It is a bit of fun, but it does probably come down to as well of trying to make these millionaire corporate people, like you say, more human and more approachable.
Which is weird because you're putting them in a mascot-y kind of.
Come on, guys.
Form,
I'm just like you. I'm in a video game. Aren't you guys in video games?
I go around collecting things and shooting enemies.
Yeah. I've got a video game based on me that you can all play for free. Don't you guys?
I prefer Mario. He's more working class, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's a plumber.
Yeah,
you know, he's.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Pat, he's been in the industry a long time. He's actually the guy, one of the main designers of the 486, you know, back in the day. And, you know, he's worked for, I think he was at VMware as well. He was a CEO there for many years. He's got a big, you know, history in the industry as well. But I think, you know, you're looking here, some people are taking this a bit too seriously. I think they're like, oh my God, this is so cringe. I think it's meant to be, though. I think you're right. It's meant to just be a bit of fun, isn't it? And the fact that it does educate you, you know.
And the fact that we're talking
about
his
history
him,
and that.
You know.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it's done its job, I think. So it's a fun little game to play for like for 20 seconds or so. I found it fun. So if you want to check that out, it's available now to play in your browser. Are you feeling the post-holiday blues yet, Joe? Are you back from your week away?
Yeah, a little bit. Today was my first day back at work and it was a bit full on. Why, have you got some good news for me?
Well, there's something to look forward to. I mean, Ravi's going away on holidays to make us all really jealous. He's off to America for a month. But I know you're going to be dialing in from your travels, Ravi, to join us for our next Patrons Hangout.
Oh, for sure, yeah. That's going to be pretty interesting, isn't it? I don't know where I'm going to do it, what the connection is. I might do it from Alcatraz. That would be fun.
That would be funny.
Well, we've got next week's show. You're going to be in your home studio for that. Then after that, yeah, we're kind of into the unknown because Ravi's going all over in America. You're going to San Francisco, you're going to New York as well.
Silicon Valley, going to VCF as well. Going all over the place. Yeah, it's going to be crazy. And I'm going to come back full of burgers and fries. I can't wait.
But I mean, Ravi is going to keep on doing the show even though you're on holiday. That is commitment, I think.
You've got to work as well, haven't you?
Exactly. And you love doing it. This doesn't feel like work, does it? We love doing this every week. So we just want to say a huge thank you to the people who enable us to keep doing the Retro Hour podcast each and every Friday. And that is our wonderful patrons. Now, actually, if you join us on Patreon at the moment, it is a really good time to get involved. Not only will you be able to join us for this month's hangout and get to see whatever exotic location that Ravi's in, because we do this every month, once a month on a Sunday night, a couple of hours. We send the invite out. I mean, we generally get, I'd say, you know, 30, 40 people generally join us now. So it's a really good chat. We all just nerd out about all things, you know, retro gaming, technology, movies. We talk about music, all sorts of stuff. Just a really chilled hangout. You can come and, you know, just watch if you don't want to take part, but it's always fun to see new people in there as well. And we always like to see people's gaming collections and systems and stuff as well, because they normally put ours to shame, actually, don't they, the people on the hangouts?
Oh yeah, definitely. Some of them are unreal. I'm just like, oh, I need a whole new house for that. So but they are amazing to kind of gawk at and drool over.
Yeah, so all patrons get invited to that. If you'd like to join us for this month, if you join us on Patreon now, you'll see the details of that coming up soon. And you get to listen to, if you're a gold member or above, our exclusive patrons-only podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours. Now, actually, listen back to the latest one that we just released, all about retro handhelds. That was a really fun episode, actually. Just getting a lot of talk about, you know, our school days and playing, you know, Lynx and Game Boys and birthdays, yeah, you know, and Christmases and going on holiday.
The best part about it was talking about batteries, like just the memories of batteries and the hunt to try and get cheap ones. Yeah, it really had a memories flooding back. And you know, it's not something we talk about that much on the show, handhelds, actually. And it was really good to do a full kind of, it was nearly 2 hours, wasn't it, getting deep into handhelds.
And I think maybe it's on our mind at the moment because we've all got holidays, you know, either coming up or just gone. That was always the thing for me, you know, playing handhelds. Mm. On even now, you know, 3DS on my Switch is always the thing that passes a long plane journey. So I think, you know, they're definitely a big part of that, kind of coming into summer. You know, a lot of people will remember handheld memories from then. So if you want to get access to our patrons exclusive podcast, and there is like, what, 22 episodes that you unlock? So you can listen to loads of After Hours episodes if you join us on Patreon. But really the main reason that you're doing it is just to keep the show coming out each and every Friday. You also get the normal show ad free. We give you exclusive content each week as well. So if you'd like to sign up on Patreon, all the details are at theretrohour.com. And of course you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame, which I still haven't got any music for.
That's like 3 weeks on the trot now.
And I'm slacking, aren't I?
It's not good enough, that.
Hall of Fame.
Maybe, I was thinking maybe Ravi could like sing something in the background.
I'm going to have to compose some Hall of Fame music.
Well, this week, let's give a huge thank you to our latest patrons, the fabulous Ian Lewis.
Richard Frozenwell.
Super Lit Mario.
Cliff Garrett.
And Rodrigo Borges.
Who all join us on Patreon. We hugely appreciate your support. And if you'd like to join them, you'll find the details at theretrohour.com. Now, this is something that I didn't realize there was much of a need for this, but now I've seen this little video that you put out on our messenger a bit earlier on today, Ravi. I've not seen this before. A universal keyboard for Ataris.
Yeah, this is really cool, actually. I've always looked at the Atari keyboards and I thought, those slanted keys, oh my God, they're so sexy.
And on the ST and the Falcon.
Oh yeah, on the ST keys, and the Falcon. So this is a case that's kind of a universal Atari keyboard case. And it's standard for the STF, the STFM, the STE, and the Falcon keyboard. And then they can be used on the Atari Mega, the Mega STE, the TT. And also one thing that I used to massively drool over, which was desktop converted Atari computers. I don't know if you've seen those.
Is that where people put like the ST inside like a desktop case?
Yeah, and then, or even Falcons, and then there's like stuff like Radeon cards in there. Kind of madness. But this is actually going to be made free on a Thingiverse, or it might have a charge with it, but it'll be STL files, so you'll be able to print it yourself. But it's been created in resin, and this keyboard has some pretty amazing features. So it allows you to use USB and wireless mouses, which is a pretty good bonus. Two joysticks can be plugged in at the same time as using the USB mouse. It's got a recessed kind of USB and mouse ports at the bottom for easier access. So do you remember with the Ataris underneath, you'd have to kind of plug them in underneath, and it was always a bit of a faff, wasn't it? To kind of,
I've got one set up next to me right now, actually, and yeah, I've never liked that about the ST. And the Falcon, I believe, is the same, isn't it? You've got to lift it up, and the mouse, I don't know if you've ever seen one, Joe, but the mouse and joystick connector are literally underneath the machine.
Oh,
so you lift it up and you've got to plug it in the bottom, which it always felt a bit odd.
I'm looking at the video now, but yeah, I didn't know that about the originals, no.
And it's also means you can set a kind of floppy LED as well if you're using it with the desktop converter. And you can also use some extra floppy lights and stuff, and it's got LEDs in there, a power LED. And what do you kind of think of this, guys? Like, it's got stereo speakers in there as well. It's
I was going to say, you missed out the speakers.
Yeah, it's like a full powerhouse, this little device here. And I guess you can use all these little adapters in there as well and stuff that seem to be made in the Atari market. Can you hear that I'm not an expert on Atari here?
Well, you know more about it than me.
What I think as well, like, I mean, obviously there were, you know, you mentioned stuff like the, you know, the TT and the Mega, which were kind of the desktop Ataris. You know, they were in like a separate case that housed the motherboard and the floppy drive, and then the keyboard was a separate thing. But I remember, you know, on those machines, the keyboards, they just looked a bit more like standard PC keyboards. They didn't have those, you know, those features you mentioned, like the slanted function keys and stuff like that, which again, I mean, I've got to say, I don't find the Atari ST keyboard to be particularly comfortable to use. I find the keys a little bit mushy on it.
Okay.
You know, it always felt like a budget keyboard, but it's undeniable that it looks incredibly cool. And I think, you know, if you have got one of those desktop converted things, and there is something about, you know, that kind of takes a soul out of just plugging in a generic keyboard, isn't there? You know, like a PC keyboard into a retro machine.
Yeah, you so still have like the same feel, because it would be the same kind of keys in there, basically. It's just rehoused into this kind of monster. And I don't know how rare they are to get original keyboards and stuff like that for the Atari. But like having this with USB and wireless mouse and stuff is just a really good idea. And being able to print it yourself, I can imagine you can use your own pigment and you can choose the kind of colors that you want and customize it. You know, I can imagine this is when he does release the STL files on Thingiverse, you know, there'll be some really amazing kind of versions that will come out, and crazy colors and all sorts.
I've got to say, I mean, you know, 3D printing feels like it's come on a hell of a long way just in the last 5 years. You know, I'm seeing some really good quality 3D printed products now, whereas before you could always tell, couldn't you? They always had those kind of lines and stuff on the surfaces, and they never look quite right. But I think there's been some, you know, really good stuff coming out recently.
Yeah, this was done in resin, it says, so it's like really beautifully well done. But yeah, I've even seen metal 3D printing, you know, people 3D printing things in metal. So imagine a metal one of these. Ooh.
Yeah, so if you want to check out the video, I mean, there is like a little 10-minute overview of him using it on various Atari systems. I've got to say, I mean, looking at that, I mean, apart from the color, which obviously this is a prototype version, I imagine, it looks like it could be like a proper, genuine factory-made keyboard.
Yeah, it looks really good, yeah. And a lot of thoughts obviously gone into this, so check it out.
Now, let's talk about something that we've talked about several times on the show, one of our favourite topics, and that is what pains Nintendo are to the retro community sometimes, because I can't get my head around this one. This is another instance of Nintendo just being unreasonable to the retro community. They've actually taken down some scans of a 1996 Mario 64 guidebook.
This is, it's just getting silly now. Like, I love the headline on Kotaku is literally, Nintendo takes some cool stuff off the internet, like get some cool stuff taken again off the internet again for like the millionth time. So yeah, about a month ago, a user uploaded a essentially a Japanese exclusive guidebook that came out in 1996 for Super Mario 64. So we never got this in the West, and it's all written in Japanese as well. So you'd think, oh, what's so interesting about an old guidebook in Japanese? But the really cool thing about this is this particular guidebook. I don't know if you guys have seen it, because it's not in the article. So I encourage you to go give it.
I imagine Kotaku don't want a chance.
Yeah,
it's on Pirate Bay now.
So go, if you just go Google like Mario 64 guidebook, it comes up. But essentially what this guidebook did is it made 3D models of every single level in the game out of like plasticine. That's the only way I can describe it. Like, you know, like contours and stuff, you know, like you'd make in like geography class at school.
Wow.
And literally, it's got like a you know, isometric view of the levels with like mountainsides and fields and, you know, all the enemies on there made out of like, you know, pipe cleaners and stuff like that. But it's really well done and it's really adorable. And I would love it if these models still existed somewhere. So, you know, if you're listening to this, go have a Google of it and have a look at it. Like I say, the actual guidebook itself has been taken down, but there's a few pictures embedded in some websites and stuff still, so you can...
For now.
So you can have a look at them. But yeah, it was uploaded onto Comfort Food Video Games, and essentially they don't know why it was taken down.
By taking it down, they've probably increased the interest in it.
Yeah,
people exactly. To go, oh, I mean, this is great. You know,
interesting you should say that, because I actually saw the article to say that it had been uploaded like a month ago, and I thought of putting in our news, but I just never did. Like, I was like, oh, you know what, it's not a big news story. And here we are now. It's become a bigger news story because Nintendo have taken it down. And
do you
now
reckon
we wanna...
there's a guy that just sits in a room in Nintendo who's like, taking it down,
take it down, get rid of it. Well, what's interesting is it's come from Nintendo of America, not Nintendo of Japan.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, that might not have anything to do with it, but the guy who runs Comfort Food Video Games is saying it's just bizarre that it's Nintendo of America, because they've... Why are they concerned with a guidebook from Japan in 1996? And it's not like anybody's making any money off it, because nobody was making any money off it on the website for it being embedded and uploaded on there. And Nintendo can't possibly make any money from the guidebook from, you know,
unless they were planning to kind of re-release it. I can't see.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just Nintendo.
We've been working on that guidebook for years.
Yeah, we're bringing it out ourselves. But apparently this guidebook's really expensive to find on eBay or on like Yahoo auctions from Japan. It is quite a sought after expensive guidebook, but you can't even argue Nintendo are taking it down because of it's so expensive to buy, you know, so we don't want it out there. We want people to buy it because it's not like Nintendo are making any money off it, because it's the aftermarket. It's not Nintendo listing. Yeah,
the only winners are eBay traders, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So as always, it's a very odd situation, but the magazine itself, the guidebook itself, is so adorable.
Well, it was on archive.org. That's where they uploaded it to. Mm. And it said, you know, you read through that there's actually quite in there from Comfort Food Video Games. And they were saying, yeah, archive.org got the usual standard takedown notice that Nintendo of America send out to them. I think, you know, whenever anything Nintendo gets put on there, I've got a feeling they just automatically send this kind of cease and desist email.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it is. But I've got to say, I mean, you know, because archive.org is kind of, it's the biggest effort in the world to preserve this kind of history.
And they've probably got the Nintendo... biggest team of lawyers as well, archive.org.
Well, they are saying they don't want to take on Nintendo's legal team.
Okay.
You know, there's no reason that they'd want to do that or spend the time and money. Because, I mean, I've got a feeling, you know, archive.org is a non-profit organisation, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, it's not the kind of thing where they're going to waste millions fighting Nintendo in the courts for something they'll probably lose, you know, if Nintendo's lawyers got on there. But again, you just ask the question that, why are they so protective? You know, there's got to be a bit of common sense in there somewhere. You know, it just seems to be a blanket. Right, it's got Mario on there. That's got to come off, you know, unless it's on our website kind of thing, which just seems really bizarre, isn't it? And I mean, I kind of get the feeling that Nintendo are getting worse at this as well.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like every other week we're either talking about something Nintendo have taken down or, you know, or a game that's had to have been changed, you know, the assets are too close, so they've done this, that, and the other to it. Like, it's a very strange situation, considering Nintendo is such a happy, family-orientated company. They do seem a little bit,
aggressive.
Yeah, hardcore. Aggressive. Yeah. That, hardcore, aggressive. Yeah, they're good words when it comes to these kind of things, but I don't think they'll ever change. I think this will always be the case with Nintendo. But it's just, like you say, it just seems to be getting more and more ridiculous. It's a magazine. It's not even a game. It's not a video. It's not footage. Nobody's making any money.
But luckily, they do say an anonymous person actually made a torrent magnet of it as well, which is apparently out there. I'm just saying, you know, if you were looking at this article, you might find a link somewhere if you want to check that out. So come
but
on,
not
Nintendo,
in the show
sort it
notes.
Out. Not our show notes, obviously, but if we happen to link to a website that's got that on, that's obviously beyond our control. Now, before we get into our interview this week, catching up with the incredible James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, let's just take a quick moment to give a big thank you to this week's sponsor, and that is our friends at BetterHelp Online Therapy. Now, obviously, at the moment, I mean, you know, the world's been going through so many changes over the last couple of years. And, you know, we often talk about physical health, don't we? People are always, you know, we're thinking they're going to the gym, getting, you know, in shape for summer this year as well. If you've got, you know, a headache, you'll take a tablet for it. You know, if you've got problems with your teeth, you'll go see a dentist as well. But a lot of the time, we don't consider just how important our mental health is.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll always be the one to talk about mental health and be an advocate of mental health. And I'm a really big, strong believer in talking about mental health and not seeing it as a weakness or anything like that. And I'm a real big, strong believer in there doesn't have to be a diagnosis for mental health. It doesn't have to be like, you know, I've got this wrong with me, or I've got that wrong with me. You can just have bad days. You can just have good days. You can have bad weeks, bad months, bad years. And when these things happen, there is absolutely no shame in reaching out and reaching out to apps like BetterHelp. And I said it before, I'll say it again. If you bought a brand new car and you got told that's the only car you're ever, ever going to have for the rest of your life, you could only ever have this one car, you'd wash it every week, you'd take care of it, you'd get it serviced every year, you'd get you know, you'd do everything you can to keep it pristine. So why don't we do that with our brains and with our bodies? The only thing that we only get one chance at life, and we only get one chance with our mind. So we need to look after ourselves, and BetterHelp is the perfect way to do that, especially if, you know, you just want to do it on your phone, because there's so many things you can do with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's online therapy that offers a video version. You can do it on the phone as well. There's even live chat sessions with your therapist as well. Thing about it is, I mean, you can do it from the comfort of your own home. You don't even have to put your camera on if you don't want to. And I think one misconception about therapy is that it's only for rich people.
Yeah.
And it's really expensive. And this is obviously a lot more affordable than in-person therapy. So you can give it a try, you know, see if online therapy can help lower your stress and help you out. You know, everyone needs it now and then. So give it a go. And actually, for using our exclusive link, you will get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. So our link is betterhelp.com/retro, betterhelp.com/retro, so they know that we sent you. And a big thank you to our friends at BetterHelp for their support of our show. Right, next, we are going to be joined by someone who we've wanted on the show for such a long time, and it's such a good interview as well. Catching up with James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd, next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Jones Topsoil has been delivering topsoil, mulch, sand, and gravel. For greener lawns and brighter flower beds, call 1-800-TOPSOIL. Order online at jonestopsoil.com.
Jones Topsoil brings it home to you.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favourite bit of the show when we welcome on a very special guest. And actually, our guest this week is someone who I think we've wanted to talk to since we started doing this podcast, like, what, 6 years ago now? And really, the guy, you know, every YouTuber we've talked to always mentions our guest this week as being one of their biggest inspirations. I don't want to make you blush or anything, but let's welcome you on. James Rolfe, how are you doing, James?
Doing very good, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, really appreciate you joining us now. Obviously, we need to talk about AVGN and, you know, the veteran of YouTube, really, you could say you are. But I think it's always nice to kind of get a bit of background on our guests. I mean, kind of going back to, you know, James as a kid, I mean, what was your first gaming experience then? Do you remember kind of what initially got you into video games?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of a blurry memory, but I remember my grandpa and my cousin introducing me to some games at a very young age. This was before we had NES, so it was a lot of DOS games, a lot of Magnavox Odyssey 2.
Nice.
Yeah, and Atari, of course, Atari 2600. The Atari, I believe, was my aunt's, or my, it could have been my grandpa's, I'm not sure. NES was the first one where I got it as a birthday present, I believe. And I would have been 8 at that point.
And before then, was there much of an arcade scene where you were growing up?
You know what? I didn't really go to the video arcades as often, more when, in my teen years. So that kind of came later. So I wasn't really in the, you know, in the arcade scene when Pac-Man and Donkey Kong was going on. I was a little too young for that.
Yeah.
I was born in 1980. So if that puts a timestamp on it.
in terms of like the NES then, was that kind of like how you fell in love with gaming? So you'd played the Atari, you'd played a couple of computer games and maybe seen a bit of arcade. What was it about the NES?
First side scroller, first time where it was just really surprising when the level was over, but the game continued. Like I never really saw a game that lasted as long as Mario. It was kind of like an ongoing thing, and it was a lot more challenging than any game I played before that. It was definitely a game changer.
I'm guessing you were used to just seeing the Atari screen, the one screen, you get a high score, and then all of a sudden you've got a game with worlds and 20 levels and stuff like that.
So no music, no pause button.
the light guns and all of that. So was there much of a Sega scene? Did you know anybody with a Master System when you got the NES?
Yeah, I saw the Genesis first, though, or Mega Drive, but I guess we call it Genesis here.
Yeah.
But I remember when that came out, my next door neighbors had it.
Mm.
But I also remember I had another neighbor at another time who had the Master System, and it was the only person I knew who had one. And I thought that it would be, because the Genesis, we just call it Sega. You know, everybody just called it Sega.
It's the same here in the UK. Everybody just called it Sega, yeah.
Yeah, and then my friend was like, "Oh, I got the Sega Master System," and I'm like, "Whoa, the Master System? That's got to be better than the Sega, right? Because this is the Master System." So I played it, and I'm like, "Well, what is this?"
It's funny because of exactly the same for me. I was born in 89, but my older brother is a similar age to you, and he had a Mega Drive. And when we were growing up, our neighbor had a Master System, and we thought it was the better system.
Because
of the name. You know, we were too naive with the graphics and stuff. We just assumed it was the next one. So it's really funny. That's this kind of story.
Yeah.
All in the branding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it wasn't too big over here. But I hear it was very big in, where was it? I think South America.
Mm.
It was a lot more popular.
Yeah. The Master System. They still manufacture the Master System in Brazil. Something to do with like taxes and licensing, but.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But South America and Europe, it was much, 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 much bigger.
Yeah. I remember a friend of mine had, because we had the Master System 2, and he had Alex Kidd in Miracle World built into it.
Mm.
But his mum didn't buy him any other games. So literally, that's the only game that he had for the system, the built in game. And you just played that every weekend for like years.
I remember this, the friend of mine, it was Missile Defense was the built in game on that particular console.
I mean, talking about the NES, obviously that was a phenomenon when that came out. I mean, what were kind of your, is there any games that stick in your mind as being, must plays and games that really defined you that you constantly go back to?
You know, it's got to be the Contra games. You know, those were huge Castlevania games, but they were a little bit too difficult maybe at the time. Like those kind of required a lot of, a lot of hours to, get your skills up. Contra was a little bit more like it was like a fair difficulty, I thought.
And what early games really got you frustrated? You know, which ones kind of stood out as horrible games and which ones ended up going into the nerd episodes?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if I'd say it was a horrible game, but Ghosts and Goblins was a difficult and frustrating game. And I remember I couldn't pass the first level when I was a kid, or maybe once I got to level 2 or something, but it was so hard. And never beat it until I was an adult and making the nerd episode.
You've done a lot better on that game than I have. I don't think I've still made it past the first level all these years later.
Yeah, it's really tough.
What about, when you used to get games as a kid then? Was it like a local game shop that you used to go to get your games?
Yeah, there was a lot of them. Try to think of what was the most common. I mean, we had Funko Land. A lot of them were toy stores like... KB's and Kitty City, Toys R Us, like bigger chains.
Mm.
But there were small ones. Well, I remember a lot of games would get resold. So if you were in the 16-bit era, if you were buying some 8-bit games that have some small like computer stores that were like just reselling old stuff, and then you could trade stuff in too. So I remember various places.
And did you trade much in, or because obviously you quite famous for keeping a lot of your stuff. Did you ever trade anything, Quinn, or was it always just a case of getting your pocket money, getting your allowance, and just buying new games?
Yeah, I did trade in a lot of games around the time, I think around the time N64 came out. Yeah, I traded in a lot of the old ones or sold them for like a few dollars or whatever. It wasn't very much that you'd get for them, like maybe 10 bucks or something like that at most. Because all the old NES games, I didn't think that people would still be playing them or talking about them. But then I regret later selling a lot of them. Yeah. I did keep a lot too, though. Like a lot of the games I own, there's probably a handful of them that are still my childhood games, but I did sell quite a bit too.
I was going to ask that actually, whether, you know, your collection now, was there ever a stage where you kind of got out of retro gaming and then just started to, you know, buy everything back again, which I think I'm definitely guilty of that.
Yeah, definitely. It was around when I started the Nerd Episodes, started collecting again. You know, I started getting nostalgic for that stuff around that time. I kind of had like a little corner, which was like my NES area, just like one little corner. And now it's a whole room. So
was the one thing that kind of instigated you kind of starting collecting again? Was it one item?
I can't remember if it was one. I think it might have started with the games I liked. But for the episodes, it was all about, you know, the games that the games you don't want to remember, the ones that were terrible. But that made them, you know, fun on a whole new level to be able to share it with people and have a good laugh.
And I think, James, you're often to blame for these, you know, awful games suddenly selling for so much money on eBay.
Oh, yeah, I've been told that a lot. Yeah.
So just going back to the kind of Genesis and Mega Drive, how did you feel when the Genesis came along? Did it feel like a challenge to the Nintendo? Like a big challenger to the Nintendo's leadership? Because obviously you were a big Nintendo fanboy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it was definitely like, you know, it had the really aggressive commercials where they make fun of Nintendo and everything, which was hilarious. They had there was a documentary that came out recently that was really good. I forget the Console Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really good. That sums it up best. But, I remember the commercials and, kind of being a little bit like tempted or like, oh, I want to get a Genesis now. And I ended up just waiting for the Super Nintendo, but my next door neighbors had the Genesis. So we used to go over each other's houses and play each other's games. So we had like the best of both worlds, but it was funny. It was like a, you know, at school, like it was like a friendly competition sort of thing. Like, oh, you're a Sega kid. I'm a Nintendo kid, you know? Like, oh, Genesis is better. Like, oh yeah, well, wait till you see the Super Nintendo. That's going to be better than Genesis.
my friend's dad's brother's got one, and I've played it. That's usually what we had in the playground.
Then PlayStation came along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone at my school had, like, a distant cousin who owned a Neo Geo, but no one ever saw one. That was, like, the mythical system when I was a kid, I remember.
It was very mystical. It was, or mythical, yeah, whichever it was you said. But yeah, I didn't know anybody who had it, but I did always hear of somebody who knew somebody who claimed to have had it. And it was the most expensive console known at the time. Mm. And it had to be the best, right? It had to be. But yeah. Yeah.
And it was just like what rich Japanese kids had, really, wasn't it? From what I heard.
Yeah. I don't know if it was circulated a lot around the States. Like, I don't remember, because I'd never seen one in person until adulthood. And you know, now I own one. It's interesting because it really is kind of just like a home arcade sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cartridges are as big as the boards.
Yeah. so far the only games I really played on it are fighting games. I don't know if that's
it's the same in the UK. It was, once again, people heard of it, but nobody ever saw it. I didn't see one until, you know, early 20s. You know, and I think it was literally the episode, I can't remember what episode it is, but where in the starting you have the cartridge and you weigh it in the intro of one of the earlier episodes. And it was like, what's that? What's that? And I had to look it up and it was like, oh, it's the Neo Geo. I remember hearing about that. I'd never seen it. Oh,
yeah. That's funny. Yeah, a lot of people would ask me like, oh, so do those really weigh 60 pounds? I'm like, no, I was pushing on it.
Yeah. I loved your video that you did on, because you've done a few videos on that kind of weird era. You know, kind of after Genesis and Super Nintendo, then we had stuff like the Atari Jaguar, and the 3DO and the Amiga CD32. I know you've done videos on all of those systems. How did you kind of feel about them, you know, when you were a kid? Did you see much of them around, or is this stuff that you've kind of discovered in hindsight, these kind of, you know, flopped systems?
some of them I heard about at the time and others I didn't, like the Philips CDI. I never heard of that one till later, but I did hear of the real 3DO, the Panasonic 3DO. So when the Sony PlayStation came along, I thought it would just be another one of those. So that's why I didn't really expect the PlayStation to be such a big deal, because I was saving up for the N64. And I had a friend who had a PlayStation, and it looked great, but I had a long way to go to wait for the N64. And it seemed like in that delay, I might as well have gotten a PlayStation at the time, but that's just how it was.
Yeah, so remember the N64. It was delayed by, you know, it probably in hindsight it was only like 18 months, but as a kid it felt like years.
It did.
You know, waiting for that machine to come out.
Yeah, like it probably wasn't actually as long, but it felt that way. But I just remember waiting for that when it was called the Ultra 64. Mm. And the launch title I was most excited for was Killer Instinct, but that didn't even become a launch title by the time it came out. They had Killer Instinct Gold, the sequel. I think by that point, PlayStation had already got enough traction and took over. Yeah, in hindsight, I that's just how I sort of missed the whole PlayStation thing. I mean, I played some of it. I played some of the first couple Resident Evils when they came out. I played Twisted Metal, but I didn't play Metal Gear Solid or Final Fantasy VII. The games that, like the major games that you hear about, just went over my head. And by that point, I was shortly after the N64. I was busy with college and just didn't really play games as often. Well, then I started playing them a little more often because I had friends in college. But we would play GameCube when that came out. Usually more co-op or competitive games, like one of the Bond games, Nightfire. More like party games we would play.
Yeah, drinking games.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, that whole era as well when, you know, everything went kind of 3D, that was, you know, every game had to be made into 3D from like 1995 onwards. What did you feel about that at the time then? Did you kind of think it was, you know, were you impressed and thought this is going to be the future of gaming? Or because I know a lot of games didn't really do that transition all that well, did they? I mean, famously stuff like, you know, Bubsy 3D and, you know, stuff that was tried to be forced into 3D that was terrible. What did you think of it when you saw 3D gaming?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, looking back, there's a lot of crap, I guess. But when I, at the time, I remember Mario 64 feeling really cool. Like that was really awesome that you could run in a circle and it felt smooth. The joystick on the controller was responsive and it felt like the future. So I think I was impressed at the time. But I guess fortunately I skipped over Bubsy and a lot of those type of games.
Well, you got lucky.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, over the years you've accumulated a huge gaming collection. Are there any highlights or rare items that you're most proud of in the collection now?
You know, off the top of my head, the original Magnavox Odyssey. Mm. I have it in the box and everything. Every piece is in there. Like, even the factory batteries are in there. Wow. Mm. Yeah, so that one, like, I don't know how hard that is to find, but I just know that having that, it's like the original game console, like the first piece one ever. So, yeah.
And obviously now that you do this, you know, for a living, are you still like an avid collector, or do you kind of have to do some separation between kind of your work life and personal life?
Oh, I still collect a little bit, not as much because, you know, the room's full and most of the games I was ever looking for, I have now. Mm-hmm. And the only reason now where I would get something else is if it's a specific game needed for an episode. So I kind of just treated on a case-by-case basis. Just what do I need for the videos?
So speaking of videos, you were a big home movie maker as a kid. How did you get started and what really ignited that flame? Because of, you know, you've posted over the years so many things from such a young age with, you know, with the home cameras and stuff.
Yeah. I think by accident, I think from just being bored or from just messing around. It was always in the arts. I think it didn't really matter too much what it was. It just that I had to do something in the arts and entertainment. Mm. So I would draw, I would paint, I would do stuff like that. Then I came to a crossroads where I could go film or animation. And I decided to go film because I found live action was a little bit more tangible. It was I enjoyed being around people, I guess, more. The animation, I felt like I could do anything with it because animation, the possibilities are limitless, but it felt too time consuming, too many long, lonely hours just drawing. And, you know, I guess I found film a little more exciting as I get outside and, you know, play with my friends. And that's what we would do. My friends would come over, we'd make a movie in the backyard. Mm. And sometimes these movies would just come about spontaneously on a weekend. And they're not much to look at now, but they were instrumental in getting that sort of practice needed to think fast and like figure out what kind of shots you need to put it together and make some kind of story that sort of makes sense enough, you know? So yeah, that's where it all started.
What kind of setup did you have? I mean, I imagine obviously you started with a video camera, but did you kind of, do you remember what camera it was? And did you expand to like VHS editing systems or Genlux, that kind of thing? How far did you go with it?
They were on VHS-C. It was the compact size VHS. I think it was a JVC camera. It was my parents' camera. And then I just sort of, you know, would keep borrowing it and eventually it became mine. And then I got another one. I got for Christmas, I got a full-size VHS camera. And that was cool because it could shoot longer. I could shoot up to 2 hours on a tape, which now is kind of funny to think, like, why did I need 2 hours? But the editing was only done on two VCRs. And I would make subtle advances throughout the years. I would find a way to do audio dubbing and stuff like that. I went to some summer and Saturday courses at a university where they had proper editing equipment, but it was analog. It was, you know, just a step up from the VCRs. But I, you know, didn't get a lot of time on that. It was sort of, you know, because you'd be competing with every other student in the class to, you know, to sit down on the machines and edit. But I always wanted my own and never actually got those. It was way too expensive and didn't even know where to get them. But I ended up just making it work with my two VCRs and got a pretty good VCR that had a flying erase head, they called it, where it had a clean edit. When you hit record, it doesn't have all the fuzz, all the static.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and then finally computers came along, but it was a really slow transition. Like I didn't have my own computer that was capable of editing until much later, well into my college years.
And it's crazy to think now, you know, how quickly we can do something in like Final Cut or Premiere or something like that. The process of doing that VHS to VHS, you know, I don't know how we actually found the effort to do that because it was just so much hassle, wasn't it?
It was crazy. Just to think that even to add a title, I actually bought I got it for Christmas or whatever. It was a title maker. It was a separate piece of hardware that was just to make titles. You would have to play it in real time. And then you have a title loaded up and you'd fade it in and out, but you'd have to do it while the tape was copying to the other tape. Crazy. And now you could make a title so easily.
Yeah. And if you timed it wrong, you messed the whole thing up.
Yeah. You had to go back. Editing in order. Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh. Imagine trying to make an AVGN episode on VHS. That could be an interesting idea for you one day. That might be a fun episode.
It could, yeah. It'd be a good challenge to go back to it. That would really be a trip because those were, oh, man, like looking back, that was a nightmare. Yeah. But it was either that or don't do it at all. So I guess that was the only way.
Well, let's get on to, you know, your most famous character then. Where did the idea of AVGN come from then? Because I mean, like we said before, you were very early to this kind of retro gaming thing. And I think actually at the time, it wasn't even really called retro gaming. It was more vintage gaming, I remember, was kind of the title it was given originally.
Oh, yeah.
Where did the idea come from to make these videos and the character?
It was really just an accident. It was just another fun thing to do. I was just messing around. And I guess the ideas really came from college because this was like right after college. But during college was the first time I ever heard from anybody who remembered those type of games. So every now and then when we weren't playing, you know, Bond, we would get out one of the old games and just sort of play around. We'd sort of laugh and make fun of them a little bit. And since I realized some people remembered them, I made the episodes, but I really thought the episodes would only appeal to my circle of friends. I didn't really think it would go that far. Mm. In fact, YouTube didn't even come out yet, so there still wasn't any real way to circulate them. It was the same thing I'd always do. I'd just copy them on VHS tapes and hand them out to friends. And then when YouTube came out, I made another one, and it started getting some attention, and then I started doing more and more. And then it sort of became like a request basis, you know, oh, you got to do more, you got to do more. And since people were enjoying them and I was enjoying them too, I just kept it going.
And at which point did it kind of like hit you that this could kind of become a bit of a career? You know, what point did you think, I'm going to stop working my 9 to 5 and do this full time? Because I think it was around 2007 that you ended up on Screw Attack on Game Trailers, you know, and I think that probably helped catapult the popularity of the Nerd. What's the kind of story there? What was the transition like?
Yeah, so at that time I'd been doing them on YouTube for about a year. Mm. And then never would have thought that you can get money for that. The Game Trailers contract was the first time I was paid to do the episodes where they would debut on Game Trailers before they'd go on YouTube. And yeah, that was really the start of it. I was still working another job at the time. At that time, I was working a wedding job. I was a videographer.
Oh, yeah.
editing weddings. And sometime in 2008, I think I started doing them less. And eventually, you know, the Nerd videos and the DVDs were able to make it so that I can do that full time.
Was that a nervous transition, that, you know, leaving your job and kind of relying on that?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
nervous about it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Especially being self-employed, not having health benefits anymore. It was risking everything. Yeah.
And was that around the time the Nerd went weekly for a while, didn't it, on Game Trailers and stuff? What was that like? Was it stressful?
Yeah, it was a bi-weekly. So it was like two a month. Oh yeah, it was really stressful because I was doing that and I was doing other videos at the same time. I was also doing I think the You Know It's Bullshit videos. Yeah. There was Monster Madness.
Yeah.
Yeah, movie reviews on Spike. Eventually Board James for a little while. Like, there's all these different shows, but yeah, it was like two a month. I remember being really sick for like a large portion of 2008. Like, I was like sick for months and months and months straight. My voice would come and go because I wasn't sleeping much, so I wouldn't want to go back to doing it that way. It was too much. I remember, you know, a lot of people saying when you're self-employed, you get to make your own hours, and I'm like, well, that's great, but what happens when you make all your hours?
Yeah, you need some separation.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, AVGN, I mean, it's gone on to be, you know, a cultural phenomenon. You know, if you talk about anyone to do with YouTube and video games, your name generally always comes up. And you made the transition to your own movie as well, with the AVGN movie.
Yeah.
What were the challenges of adapting a character from, you know, a YouTube short series, you know, short episodes, mm-hmm. to a full feature-length movie on the big screen?
The first thought was that it would be sort of like a Revenge of the Nerds, really, like, dumb comedy sort of thing. And we kept the dumb comedy, like, you know, to make it like just really just stupid and funny, you know, like a movie that doesn't take itself seriously. But the plot got a lot more complicated because then we started going the like a National Treasure Da Vinci Code route, and like sort of like uncovering these conspiracies with the ET game. Yeah, I got really, really sucked into the story, like really went deep with it. It was a lot of fun to write. It was, you know, just a lot of fun all around.
And you got people like, you know, Howard Scott Warshaw was involved in it as well. You know, the guy, we've had him on this podcast, actually, another guy behind ET.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Was that like working with him then? And how did you get him involved with it?
Oh, he was awesome. Yeah. Well, we wrote the script and we had him in mind because he's kind of similar to Leonardo da Vinci in the Da Vinci Code, where he would put hidden things in the, you know, in his work, because he would put his initials, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like in Yar's Revenge, you could find his initials. So we thought, well, what if he made ET as a floor plan of Area 51, or you can decode it and find the location of the captive alien, the real alien in Area 51. Mm-hmm. So we went really far with the story. And I remember I wanted to have a really good script to show him. So we waited until we had everything written out. But then as the time got closer, I remember getting more and more nervous, like, oh, well, what if he doesn't like it? Because we put all this work into it. So we showed it to him and you know, he liked it, but he wanted to scale back the character a bit. So he was originally going to play like the Xander character, but he ended up taking more of like a mentor sort of role in there. And it worked out better for the long run. And having him on set was amazing. Like, it was really... really kind guy, and just having him there and the fans there at the same time, like just to come out into this random spot in the desert to watch me and Howard, you know, act and say our lines. It was really just a magical moment. You know, I can't even describe it to do it justice.
I also think it must be quite surreal for him as well, you know, the fact that he's kind of taken it under his wing, this, you know, I killed the video games industry kind of thing, hasn't he? And he takes it in his stride, but it must be weird for him, I imagine, seeing all these documentaries made about, you know, and movies being made about his, you know, biggest failure in his career, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, his book, Once Upon Atari, is really great. It goes into all that.
So would you want to make another movie? Because I know you were incredibly busy when you're making a nerd movie and doing everything else at the same time as well.
Oh yeah. It depends. Cause you're not asking a nerd sequel. You're just saying another movie, right?
Just a movie in general. Yeah. I mean, a nerd sequel would be awesome, but just a movie. Oh, yeah.
No on the nerd sequel. Cause I want to make something different, but, definitely, something different. I've done a short film a couple years ago. I did a short film, The Head Returns, which was a sequel to The Head Incident from 99. So it was kind of like did the Halloween H2O sort of thing. Like, I went back to the story, which was fun. So I found that I really loved doing short films. I think I might like them more than features because it's more like a shorter Twilight Zone type format. I think it's more condensed because I wrote a feature horror film. To be realistic, it's going to take years and years to film. I mean, it's not as complicated as the nerd movie, but still it's going to take over my life for years and years. And once you start a movie, then you're past the point of no return. Like, now you just keep on going and going and going until it's finished. And during that time, that's like almost all you're doing is just that movie. And it's all you're thinking about. And like, I don't want that right now. I'd rather have something that I could make it quicker and, you know, not have it overstay its welcome. And I think that the horror feature, like, I rewrote it as a short, and I think it's better as a short, like as a 30-minute film, something like that.
Is that the with the roller coaster in the castle?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's the abandoned amusement park one. Yeah. So I think I'm planning to make it as a short once I'm caught up with, you know, some other, because I have some other videos I'm trying to make too. There's some other like secret projects I'm working on, so it's in the queue. It'll happen, but just, you had to wait for, you know, COVID to get under control and being able to get out in the world more, and things need to be a little more stable, you know, before I make such a big decision to a life-changing, you know, project.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, I mean, you know, talking about your videos from AVGN, Jack Tramiel passed away a few years ago. Did you ever hear of the rumor you were talking about Sword Quest was true then, that he had the treasures?
I haven't heard a single thing, no. it's been a while since his death, yeah. Mm. Obviously, when he first died, I wasn't going to be like, oh, well, let's find the treasure, you know, but...
the premise of the second AVGN film.
Yeah. But, so, you know, so much time has passed, and I haven't heard anything at all. You'd think maybe, like, someone somewhere would have, you know, found something, but I guess that was all... I mean, I heard that the treasures were all melted down, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Like, they were all the gold was sent back to the mint, and that's all there was. Not a very exciting treasure adventure story, but
having a myth of them still being out there somewhere, yeah, that makes it much more exciting, I think.
Yeah, we could go with that they're still out there,
still out there waiting to be found. Yeah. So, what's the typical process of making a nerd episode, and has that changed much over the last 15 years?
It's pretty much the same thing. So, you know, it starts with the gameplay. I sit down, play the game, write some notes, basically write all the parts that are frustrating or funny or anything interesting whatsoever. And then as I'm doing that, I'm recording the gameplay. And then I digest all the footage and start going through it and writing a script. The script, you know, is probably the longest part because just going through the notes and trying to figure out like, well, what kind of flow is this? Like, should I start talking about this and then go on to that? Is this funny? Is that funny? Like, once I got it all down, then I shoot it, then it goes to editing. Mm. We've had a lot of help with the editing over, especially in the past, like 5 years or so.
Yeah.
I still do some of the editing. Like it's not all outsourced, I guess I should say, but, still a lot of it is me editing. I have a lot of people help edit as well. And while they're editing, that means that I can start writing the next one. That's kind of how the flow goes. It's the most efficient that I've ever had in the whole, you know, career. And it keeps me able to do the creative parts where if there's something like, because before, you know, I would get bogged down working on the color correction, on little audio tweaks and trying to clean up the, you know, the audio and get the volume all equalized and all that kind of stuff. It's so refreshing when someone else can take that off your plate and just let you, you know, work on the fun part, you know?
Yeah, sometimes you get a bit, you know, obsessed with it, can't you? Like, oh, I just need to change it a little bit more or, yeah, you know, you can, before you know it, you spent 2 hours doing the color correction and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And even then, sometimes I have a lot of notes about it where I'm like, oh, can you make this part look a little more like nighttime or, you know, The last one I had on the last Ninja, the most recent episode, there were parts where the color correction was meant to look bad on purpose because I was recreating an old episode, like the look and feel of an old episode from 2006.
I was going to say you captured the room. The background really well then with that one because it did, and I mean I'm glad you cleared that up for me. I was really studying it like, did he film this 15 years ago? Like, I really could have
some planning if so.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's some planning that is there.
yeah it was a fun challenge, just try to make it look as close as possible. I used the exact same microphones that I used back then.
Oh wow.
I just want to see how far I could go with it.
Some dedication. And was there any abandoned episodes, like any episodes you just couldn't make work?
The only ones I remember, I think we released as DVD bonus episodes. I think one was Secret Scout. That's the only one I could remember off the top of my head. I don't think we ever like finished it. It was kind of just like a game that my friend Mike and I would play, and we just recorded it, and when we're like, okay, this could maybe be an episode. Because I have, my friends help me a lot with picking out games. Like, Mike will suggest the game. He suggested Last Ninja to me. He was like, hey, this game's really bad. You should check it out. And I did. And it was like, oh, wow, you're not kidding. This game might be the worst NES game I've ever played.
Did you ever get any bad games for like Christmas or birthday as a kid?
You know, I think I lucked out with a lot of that. I think the worst game I can recall off the top of my head was Ghostbusters on NES.
Which, just because it was Ghostbusters, everyone had to have it, didn't they?
Yeah, it was one of those where usually the movie games weren't so good.
What are some of your personal favorite nerd episodes?
In recent memory, like I'll go recent and I'll go classic. I think recent Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Majora's Mask.
Yeah.
Those were two really big ones because they were a little more story driven and there was like some, you know, sort of like sentimental content to both of those. Like there was some sort of part where I'm really, even though it's like a joke and it's like a, you know, it's just sort of like a, just meant to be a funny video. It also has some genuine material in those.
Yeah.
And then like the older ones, I remember Rob the Robot, I think, is probably my favorite old one because it had a story to it. And I remember the Crazy Castle one, as far as slapstick goes, that's a hard one to beat. Oh, well, and the Sega Activator one with Keith. Nathan Barnett.
Yeah, Keith. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. It's always fun to break a lot of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say birthday blowout as well.
Yeah.
I love that. Plumbers Don't Wear Ties, I think, was I'd never really seen that game before. And a very eye-opening game.
Yeah, I remember that episode at the time I was making it. I wasn't so sure if it was a good episode or not because I didn't really have much to add to the game. Like my commentary on it was just like, you know, look at this, because what do you say about this? Look at this insane, crazy game. But I guess it's just that, like just that the game sort of wrote the episode itself. It was like, that's all you need. Cause people would always tell me that they love that episode. So I think that's maybe what it is just that because the game was so crazy and the fact that I have such a lack of words for it, you know?
Yeah. I think it speaks for itself a bit.
Yeah.
You know, your Majora's Mask one as well. That was interesting because I remember, you know, when you release that episode, I remember thinking, oh, he's going to get it for, you know, slating that game. And then I watched it. And actually, you made a load of good points in there. And I think a lot of people in the comments were like, actually, now you mention it, you know, you're right about a lot of stuff in there. Was that kind of an episode? Did you feel a bit, you know, doing a nerd episode, kind of putting down a Zelda game? Was that a bit kind of outrageous in some ways, do you think?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's always what made them, you know, what I think made the episodes interesting. Like, going all the way back to Ninja Turtles, that game was the number one top voted game in Nintendo Power for a while, I think, for maybe a year or so. I don't know. And I was one of the first people, I think, publicly to bring up all the bad points about it to that level. I even remember Zelda 2, actually. That one kind of seems like, you know, some people like it, some people don't. So it's always good to bring about good and bad points.
It's interesting because Majora's Mask, when I saw that, it's like my favorite Zelda game and I adore Zelda. And it's interesting because when I watched that video and I first saw you kind of like obviously joking but bashing on it, it actually brought back memories because of, I think I was about 12 or 13 when that game came out. And I actually remember getting upset that it had the time limit on it before I understood how the time limit worked and that you could, you know, revert, you know, go back to the start and stuff. And I remember my mum saying, how is it, like, on Christmas Day? And I remember like holding back tears. Like, yeah, it's great, like, kind of thing. But you know, at the time I just didn't understand the mechanics, so you know, it's great that you kind of pointed it out.
Oh yeah, because it was actually my first time playing it all the way through. I played a little bit before, but not enough to get a sense of the game. So it was really like a bucket list game for me because I heard a lot about it before I played it. And I heard good and bad things. Like, I've heard a lot of people say it was their favorite Zelda game.
Yeah.
And then I've also heard a lot of people say, like, well, you know, it's interesting. It's different. It's definitely different. And I was like, well, I need to, you know, see this for myself. And I really love the aesthetic of it with the moon and everything. So it even appealed to me already before, like, it already looked like a game, like, I know I'm going to enjoy this and I'm sure there's going to be things about it that are going to frustrate me. But overall, I think this is going to be a good experience.
Yeah. So one of the questions I had to ask, because I've always wondered this, you've had some huge guests on AVGN, Lloyd Kaufman, Macaulay Culkin, Gilbert Gottfried. How did this happen? How did that come about? What's the story there? Like, the Macaulay Culkin one blows my mind.
Each one was a different case. The way we went about meeting them was different each time. Macaulay Culkin was one that came to me. So that was really interesting. Yeah. Gilbert, we went to Gilbert. We had access to him. So we asked him if he wanted to do it and he did it. Lloyd, did we do the movie cameo before that? Or I think we shot the movie cameo first. Now I'm starting to forget. Mm. Macaulay Culkin, though, was a fan. And he was a fan for a while, too. And, you know, one day the idea came up, like, if we do a Home Alone episode. And at first I thought, like, is he into this? Like, is he kind of tired of hearing about Home Alone all the time? Like, I wasn't sure. And it does seem like it's a rare case when he does something. So I felt really honored that he wanted to come here and you know, go as far to reenact the trap scene and everything. You know, I just didn't know. I was like, hey, is this too cliche or whatever? And he's like, no. Like, he really enjoyed being in the episode. And a lot of the dialogue in it, we ad-libbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you hang out with him for a couple of days? Because you did a James and Mike Monday with him as well, didn't you? The page master and stuff, like, or was it all just he came for the day?
Oh, we did. Yeah. It was a few days. Yeah. We did the page master and then the rental review. But yeah, no, being out in public with him was really fun, because just to see how what it's like when someone approaches him.
Yeah.
They'll recognize him and they'll say, like, hey, are you? And he goes, Jonathan Taylor Thomas. Yes. Like, just to see how he jokes around and messes with people, yeah, like that. It's so funny. It's totally a different, you know, kind of style to just, you know, make a funny joke, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. He seemed a really down to earth guy as well. And you could tell he was having so much fun when you did the episode with him. So it was nice to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Well, obviously you've done a lot of spin-off shows. You mentioned, you know, Bored James, you know, What's BS, Rental Reviews. Have you got any plans to do anything else you can talk about then, or anything that's coming up on the channel that we should look out for that you can mention?
Well, I'm looking forward to getting on a plane and going somewhere at some point. I haven't been on a plane in like 2 years. I actually am finally going to do a family trip though soon. So that'll be my first, take the children. But there's certain projects that I want to do that involve flying, and hopefully I'll be able to do that soon. They're also like expensive, you know, sometimes it's like flying is expensive and everything added to it. But I have some on location videos I want to do, videos that won't ever make revenue back, like, you know, they won't reimburse themselves, but still, it's like the point of doing it is just for fun. Like, I want to do it just because I want to do it. So hopefully some of those will happen soon. There's I'm working on recording a music album of cover songs.
Is that with Rex Viper?
Yeah. So we're doing that. Got a bunch of stuff going on. Just juggling a bunch of things, but I'm just enjoying it. Just you know, one day I'm working on one thing and then next day I'm working on something else. I just love doing it all, especially, you know, the way, like, you know, the past couple of years have been, it's just not been normal, you know? So it's any type of escape, any type of entertainment. It's different now. It's like, now it's, you're trying to do this type of thing to get your mind off and get other people's minds off of, you know, bad stuff in the world. And yeah, so it's like, I think I enjoy this more than ever now.
Yeah, 100%. Well, James, it's been an absolute pleasure coming on. Thank you so much for reminiscing with us and being so open and chatting about your channel and everything. It's been incredible talking to you. So thank you for coming on.
Oh, thanks so much.